Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Troy, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based upon a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal story describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problem that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, I think Tinsley is going to introduce our speaker this evening.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And it's an honor to introduce the speaker, especially when it's somebody I've known for over 30 years, which means we knew each other on the other side. And, you know, I've known Jeff a long time, but I really don't know what his story is. And I'm looking forward to tonight. I've been looking forward to tonight for a long time. So with that, I give you Jeff's seat.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic and addict. And thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the God of my understanding, and people just like you in rooms just like this all over the world, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a drug since November the 6th, 1986. And for that, I'm very grateful. That's 28 years, in case your math ain't so good. But, you know, I'd like to tell you I'm really happy to be here. Not necessarily just at this meeting. After 24 years of drinking and drugging the way I did, I'm just happy to be here. All right? And that's the truth. We rolled back in the day, Tinsley and I, and I don't remember any of it. I hope you don't either. You know, if you don't hear anything else that I say tonight, I hope you will hear this, that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. It works 100% if you do three simple things. One, you put down the drink, and you never pick up the first one after that. That goes for drugs, too. Two, you become teachable. I wasn't very teachable when I got here. I had to learn how to become teachable because I thought I knew everything. And the third thing is you've got to be willing to change. And alcoholics, in my experience, are not very willing to change. I struggle with every part of this program. I'll just say that. You know, when I first got here and looked at those steps, I wanted to change every single one of them. I did not relate to them. I didn't think they made much sense. And why not? Because I was using it and I couldn't see a different way. So what I'd like to talk about tonight, in the book it talks about the spiritual experience, and what you read is so apropos to what I'm going to talk about. You know, they describe two different kinds of spiritual experience. One, the sudden white-like experience where you experience God and your whole life changes. And then they say, and then there's the educational kind, which comes over time. And most people have that. Me, I like to say I had little miracles. That was my experience. Just one little miracle after another. And I'll tell you a little bit about me first, and that is I was born in Denver, Colorado on Easter Sunday a long time ago. I won't say the year. But I had a perfect childhood until I was about six. And then my mother started going in and out of mental institutions. And then she would disappear and not come back for days at a time and then show up again. So by the time I was about seven, they divorced, my mother and father, and I went to live with my mother. And one Saturday night, my dad came to pick me up when I was eight, and we went to a movie. And during the movie, I had this weird feeling. I just had this feeling wash over me that something was weird or wrong. So after the movie, we went back to the house, and the house was dark. And so my dad said, I'll just wait here. You run in and make sure everything's okay. So I ran in, and my mother had committed suicide on the living room floor and was dead. And that was the beginning of my spiritual crisis. You know, I prayed for God to bring her back many, many times in many, many ways, and it never worked. So I got a huge resentment toward God. And the AA program helped me work on that after I'd gotten sober. And after about 5 or 6 years, I realized that wasn't God that did that. She did that. Then I got mad at my mother. So I stayed in AA a little bit longer, and I came to realize she was sick too, because it turns out she was an alcoholic. You know, and that's what they did with alcoholics back in the 50s, is they put them in mental institutions. They didn't know what to do with them. And then she came back out, was untreated, I guess never found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she killed herself. You know, it says that we will die, you know, if we don't treat our alcoholism. So I just want to talk to you about some random little miracles that I have had. First of all, I just want to say that I had my first drink when I was 12 years old. And here's what happened. I got drunk. I threw up all over myself. I got in a fist fight, and I went to jail. I woke up the next morning, and most people would have gone, Jesus Christ, I'm never going to do that again. I woke up and went, when can we get this party started again? Says in the big book that there's a point in your drinking career when you go from casual drinking to determined drinking. Personally, I believe that my first drink was the only casual drink I ever had. That from then on, it was determined. I wanted to get as blotto as I could and just erase reality. Because I didn't like the way I felt. I didn't like how I couldn't control the fact that people were dying in my life and whatever, you know. So from the age of 12, at first I was very disciplined, because when my mother died, I escaped into a love of music. And music was about the only thing that gave me joy. And so I became a musician. But let me just say right here, I didn't study to become a musician because I didn't believe in rules. You know, like when I was 10 years old, my father would bring home a model airplane for me to put together, and I'd open up the box, I'd throw the directions away, and I'd just struggle with trying to fix that, put that airplane together. I just didn't follow rules or regulations or directions, you know. And so, I lost my train of thought. This is great. At my age, it's forgivable, I assume. But let me just get on. So I drank. I was disciplined at the beginning because I played music. I would practice very hard. And, you know, drinking after a while became a reward for a hard practice session. Never did I ever consider drinking while I was playing music or whatever. Well, anyway, we started little bands around where I lived in Denver. And I had a pretty good band that was playing around town. And one night we were rehearsing in a dress shop in the bottom of a store, and we kept hearing the door rattling. Finally, I went up to see what it was. Big blizzard, snowstorm, and there's this skinny little kid standing at the door with a guitar player. You know, I'm like 17 or 18. This kid's maybe 15. You know, and he's like, hey, man, can I jam? No. I tried to blow him off. He said, oh, no, please let me play. So he came in, he plugged in, and the guy was a genius musician. And we fired our guitar player the next day and hired him. And I was blessed to play with this gentleman for many years, and until his death of drug overdose and alcohol. We wrote many, many songs together. We had a lot of success, you know. I don't like to name drop, and I try not to do that when I'm speaking. But we were living the lifestyle. We were taking limos. We had big, giant bags of cocaine, and we were doing it off of butter knives, okay? So we were excessive. We were definitely excessive. And it's not surprising that he died at such an early age. He was actually he was on tour, and he came back after the tour, and they started partying, and he started having an overdose. He was doing speedballs, and all these people in the room, they were high too, so instead of calling an ambulance, they were paranoid and high, they just pushed him in the shower and left, and he died that night. And even though my drinking and drugging was increasing, I still remember, the denial of this thing is amazing. I still remember thinking, gee, that's tough. He just couldn't take it, you know. I do better. You know, I'm better. I know how to handle this shit. Well, that kind of thinking landed me up in my first treatment center. I got to the point where I was so toxic I couldn't work. By this time when he died, I started working for a record company, which was amazing, because now I had an expense account to use on my drinking and drugging, and that really helped my cause. And it moved it right along, you know. But so After he died, I started working for these record companies, and I went into this first treatment center. Well, you should never let an alcoholic pick their own treatment center, because I picked this place that was swimming, tennis, horseback riding, gourmet food in a mansion, no AA, right? So I went there for 30 days. It cost $10,000 back in the 80s. That was a lot of money. But my record company that I worked for paid for it. They said, you know, we're not unaccustomed to this. People with drug problems in the business, go, right? So I went in, had a great time. Didn't find out anything about how to stay sober, but ate a lot of good food. Got out and white-knuckled it for about 6 weeks, and then I went out with a vengeance. I remember being at a club in Atlanta, and I had one scotch, and the next thing I was on the phone to the drug dealer, and the next thing I know I was in Gainesville in a shooting gallery. I'd been kicked out of a bunch of clubs, and I woke up in a place that I'd never been and didn't ever want to be again. So I knew it was very serious. So I decided I was going to call my boss and tell him I needed to go to treatment again. And he said, well, fine, but this time you're paying for it. And let me tell you, from the minute I had my own money invested, I took it a lot more seriously, you know. And that's why I always put something in the basket, because I considered investing in my own recovery. If I'm willing to take a dollar out of my pocket and put it in the basket, that means I value my sobriety. So here's some of the little miracles that happened to me along the way. The first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. Well, I thought that was a deal breaker. I could see that my life was unmanageable, but I did not understand how you could be powerless over alcohol. Until one day I was in a meeting and a guy said, I'm not powerless over alcohol until I put it in. Then I don't have any idea what's going to happen. And I could relate to that, you know, because that alcohol doesn't bother me when I'm not taking it. But when I take it, bad things happen. Simple as that. So that helped me understand. And he was in one of the first AA meetings I was in treatment. And he came in and sat down next to me. I was sitting in the front row. And this guy in a suit came in and sat down right next to me. And I'm this sick guy in the treatment center, you know, in my pajamas. And the guy had a pin on his lapel, and it said, attitude. And I went, yeah, attitude, man. He goes, no, man, you don't get it. If you got a good attitude, life is good. If you have a bad attitude, life sucks. And I had to admit to myself, my life sucked. I was trapped in this treatment center. And so I had about 4 or 5 days in the treatment center, and I decided I had about enough of that treatment crap. And I announced to all the nurses in the place that I was leaving. Now, the word God does not appear in our steps until the third step. And I tried to make God another out for me. Hey, I don't want to have God here. I don't want to deal with that. I'm done with God. He killed my mother, all this stuff. Anyway, so the second step actually says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Here's my first little miracle. I announced to these ladies that I was leaving. And as I got up to walk to the door, they paged a Dr. Strong. And by the time I got to the door, there was this gigantic, muscular guy with no neck. He's just huge, standing in the doorway, and he wasn't going to let me out. He was my first higher power. I turned around and sat back down. So that was a wonderful miracle. And in the very next meeting I sat in, they were talking about the second step. And being my resentful, sick self, I challenged him. I said, you know what? I might be an alcoholic, but I'm not insane. It says, you know, could restore us to sanity. I said, I might be an alcoholic, but I'm not insane. And this guy looks at me and he goes, hey, man, did you ever spend all your grocery money on booze? Yeah. Did you ever get spit mouth drooling drunk and drive? Yeah. And he had about 4 other questions like that. And by the end of that, I realized that I had been insane. You know, it was very clear to me, and there was no dodging that bullet. And by the way, they asked me, do you know where you are? And I said, yeah, I'm in a treatment center. He goes, yeah, but it's Bronner Psychiatric Institute. It was a loony bin, and I didn't even know it. So the next thing that happened, I get out of treatment. and I go back home. And it's 4 or 5 days later, and I'm sitting at home, and all of a sudden, I get this unbelievable urge to use. So I tell my wife, listen, I'm going out to get a pack of cigarettes. I'll be right back. But I was going to go find the dope man. That's what I was going to do. So I went out to my car, and I turned the car, and the thing wouldn't start. I tried and tried and tried, and that car would not start. Finally, I gave up. I went back in the house. And the urge to use passed. About 4 hours later, my wife said, hey, can you go to the store and get some bread? I ran out to the car, and I'd forgotten all about it. I turned the car, it cranked right up. That's another little miracle. That saved my butt that day, you know. That was beautiful. When I had about a year sober, I was going to meetings. I was, you know, I had a sponsor. I did all the stuff that I was told to do, not because I wanted to, but because I did not want to get drunk again, because I knew where it was going to lead me. So I did what I was told. And at about a year sober, I got an offer to work for one of the biggest record companies in New York City, running the promotion department for dealing with radio. And I thought to myself, hey, I got a year sober. I'm a miracle. You know, I'm a spiritual giant. I'll go. Problem was, I was in love with this woman that worked at another label here in Atlanta, and she had a great job, so she wasn't coming with me. And I had to go because it was one of the opportunities of a lifetime. So I went thinking I'll be fine, you know. And I got there, and within the course of 2 or 3 days, it was really apparent I was full of fear. I was shaken. I was thinking I wanted to use. I knew it wasn't going well. And I spent one night in my apartment, which was actually 600 square feet, not much room, pacing back and forth, peeking out the windows, looking out the little hole, just old behavior, you know, and I wanted to use, and I stayed up all night long. And in the morning, I still wanted to use, and I thought to myself, I don't know anybody here. How am I going to score? Oh, I'll go to Central Park. Surely there'll be a dope dealer in Central Park. So 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm on the subway coming up to Central Park to try and score. So I'm walking through Central Park, and I'm looking down, and all of a sudden I hear Jeff, and I look up, and it's the one person in New York City, what, 12 million people? The one person I knew that was in AA and knew I was in AA too. And this woman says to me, man, you look like shit. We need to get to a meeting. And she took me to a meeting. Saved my butt. That is another little miracle. You know? And so this meeting that I went to is at Al-Anon House in New York City. It's in Times Square. It's in the big book. They talk about it. And it's the kind of place where you sit down next to a guy might get out of a limousine and sit down. And then the next guy over is, you know, puking on his shirt and passed out. Street guy, right? So all kinds of people come together there, and it was powerful, man. The message of AA was just strong in this place. And I noticed there was a guy that shared, sitting a couple of chairs away from me, and he had thick glasses on, and he was wearing cowboy boots and a bolo tie. And I'm thinking, he ain't from New York, I'll tell you that. But he had such a spiritual message, I went up to him afterwards, and I said, my name's Jeff, and he said he happened to mention he had 17 years sober. And I asked him if he'd be my sponsor. He said, yes. In New York, they say you're never more than 8-minute walk from a meeting anywhere in Manhattan. And we tested that theory. Every weekend we'd get together and we'd start down at the bottom of Manhattan. We'd just start going to meetings and we'd have lunch and then we'd go to meetings, working our way up. And we'd spend all day, both days, Saturday and Sunday, going to meetings. It was incredible. My first sponsor in Atlanta, though, he was quite different. I didn't really want a sponsor, and I was too shy to ask for a sponsor. And so the guy at the treatment center said to me, I got a guy for you. And you need to call him and have lunch with him. And I said, okay. And I'm thinking, finally, this guy gets that it's going to take somebody really special to sponsor me. That's what I'm thinking, right? And I said, well, So you think he's the right guy for me? He goes, yeah, he's the only one sicker than you are, but he's more sober. The guy comes to pick me up, and we're driving to lunch, and he has to slam on the brakes, and a machine gun slides out from under his chair. And I'm thinking, this is my guy. This is my guy. And he was my sponsor until I left for New York. He was great. Crazy as a loon, but he was sober. And he helped me stay sober. So after working in New York for about 3 years, it was really stressful, and I really wanted to be with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, in Atlanta, and we could not figure out a way. And then all of a sudden, this little miracle happened. A guy who was credited with being really the man who discovered and started Southern Rock, and he started this label down in the South that was really famous, and he signed a bunch of great R&B artists. A guy called me and said, this guy's looking to start his record company up again, and they'd like to interview you for a job. And I'm like, oh, my God. I'm going to have an opportunity to be back with my wife, get back to to Atlanta, where I love, and to do my dream job, which is run a record company. And so I took the job, and it was an amazing time. It was very exciting. We had such a great time. We broke a lot of records, a lot of big bands, had a great time. But when they started, they were in Nashville, and I was living in Atlanta. And they actually let me do that, but I would have to go up for meetings once in a while. And one time I went up for a meeting. It's a four-hour drive, right? And the meeting went terribly. We were fighting, and it was so tense and negative. And by the end of it, I was ready to quit, but I just got in the car, and I'm driving home. I'm going 80 miles an hour. I'm banging on the steering wheel. I'm totally twisted up with fear and anger, and, you know, and I'm driving along with my teeth crunched, you know, clenched, and all of a sudden, I'm going 80 miles an hour. A semi passes me, boom, like that. And you know what was written on the back in 6-foot-tall letters? Let go and let God. On the back of a semi. That's another little miracle. I got the message. I relaxed. I had a sip of water, and I let it go. Okay? Nothing's that important that I should get so twisted up, right? So one other thing, you know, in the book it talks about we have a disease of perception, that the disease of alcohol centers in the mind. And I believe that 100%. It's my thoughts, you know, it's my thoughts that get me drunk. It tells me in the book I'll get restless, irritable, and discontent before I pick up a drink. Wow, that's the way I lived when I got here. I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. But to show you how skewed your mind can still be even after you get sober. I had a couple of years sober. I'm still working for this same company. And my boss, who was famous for being a crazy man, but he had calmed down by then, he says to me one day very casually, hey, Jeff, I need to have a meeting with you. How about next Tuesday? And I went, okay. And this was like on the previous Monday. And for a whole week, I twisted up. Oh, God, he's going to fire me. I'm going to lose the biggest job of my life. I have all this money. It's great. Everything's perfect. I'm going to lose my job. And then I thought on Monday, before the meeting on Tuesday, you know what? I'll beat him to it. I'll quit this job. I'll show his ass. I'm going to quit. I'm going to tell him where to stick it. You know, but my sponsor suggested I just go to the meeting. And I did. And you know what he said? You've been doing a great job. I want to give you a bonus. He gave me the biggest bonus check I've ever gotten in my life. That was another little miracle, because I didn't deserve it. But, you know, it just shows you how wrong your thinking can be. You know, that's why I need a sponsor. I need somebody that can tell me, hey, that don't sound right. You know, I need that. Because it sounds right to me in here. But when I say it out loud, it's a little creepy. Then I lost that job, this huge job, this wonderful, perfect job that had me living in a great house, bigger than I'd ever lived in before, married to a woman that I love more than anything, just had a baby. Everything was perfect, and then life happened. I lost the job. And I didn't have another job for over a year. Went through all my savings. I took a job selling cars, didn't know how to sell cars, but I thought, oh my God, I'm a super promotion man. I will ace this. My ego, right? I failed miserably. I hadn't done math in years. And the car business is all about writing up deals and making... They went, I'm sorry, but this isn't going to work. So again, I had no job, and the money was running out. I don't know what to do. I just prayed about it, kept going to meetings, talking to my sponsor, and he'd say, you know, it'll be okay. Just don't drink and go to meetings. And so after about a year and a half, all the money's gone. I hear this record on the radio, and it's one of the guys that I love the most. You know, I've loved him for years. And I called somebody and said, man, this guy's got a new record. I didn't even know he was on a label. And they said, oh, yeah, he's on this label out of California, this little bitty label. And I said, well, who's promoting his records? And they said, well, nobody. And I thought, oh, so I'm going to reach out. I'm going to talk to these people. I'm going to see if I can get them to hire me so I can help work on this guy I love, you know. And so I called him cold. And the guy was like, no, we don't need anybody. We're a small company. We don't have any money, blah, blah, blah. I said, please, please, let me have a shot, please. So finally they said yes. Now let me tell you how God works. The company I was at before, not the one here, but the one in New York, we had the two biggest heavy metal bands in the 80s. My first thing to do when I was sober was go on the road with these two heavy metal bands, fresh out of treatment. And thank God for the fact that I knew that if I just didn't pick up the first one, and I think it through, that I'll be okay. And I did get through it. And you know what I noticed? Those guys didn't have nothing on me. I used a lot more than they did. I just didn't notice it because I was so blasted most of the time. But anyway, so it turns out I get this job with this record company, and it wasn't 3 weeks before I have this conversation with the guy that runs the company, the president, and he goes, yeah, you know, I'm sober, by the way. What? You're sober? He goes, yeah. And there's 30 people that work here. 28 of them are sober. I said, if that's not a God thing, what would be? That's a little miracle right there. So all of a sudden, I'm going from working with heavy metal heads to working in a company where there's all kinds of sober people. And it was amazing. Everybody treated everybody beautifully. Everybody had principles. Nobody's lying to each other. It was great. You know, I was really the biggest liar at the company. Because I always believed that the good lie was better than the truth any day. And I really had to unlearn that, you know. Here's what my sponsor did. He made me do. You know, my job was to call radio stations and convince them to play records, right? So I'd call a station and I'd say, you know, this record sold 1.5 million copies. Man, you got to play it. You got to, you know, blah, blah. My sponsor said, you know, that's a lie. I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you know what you need to do? You need to stop in the middle of that lie and tell that man that you're lying to him and tell him the truth. So I get on the phone. Hey, man, this record sold 1.5 million. That's not right. It's 1 million. Make it 500,000. Okay, it sold 25 copies, but you still should play it. And that was so embarrassing that I just quit lying because I didn't want to have to admit that I was lying to somebody face to face. And that really worked. Now, I've been sober 28 years, and one of the great joys is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people you meet. Extraordinary human beings, you know. We have a disease. We're not, you know, we're exceptional people. We know about pain. We know about hardship. We know about struggle. But when people get sober, they change, and it's beautiful to watch. And it's amazing to watch where their lives go. Now, I have one guy I've been sponsoring for 22 years. You know, I've had a relationship with him longer than I ever had with a woman, you know. And you know, it's just great to see how his life, it gives me hope watching how his life blossoms and becomes more and more positive all the time. Had a kid, raising a kid, doing great, having a good job. You know, life just smooth. And he still goes to meetings, you know. And my sponsor has 40 years sober. And he still goes to meetings. Because you know why? I'm going to tell you why. Are we about out of time? Yeah. We're getting close. So here's what I'm going to tell you. And I don't want to tell you this because my ego doesn't want to tell you this. But this is the truth. 27 years sober. Coming up on my 28th anniversary. It was a week before my 28th anniversary. My wife and daughter announced that they are going on a camping trip and they'll be gone for a week. Great. Have a great time. I love you. Please go have fun. They leave. I go into the garage to get something and I open this cabinet and there's two bottles of wine sitting there that my wife drinks wine occasionally. I don't begrudge her that. I don't care. It never bothers me, except for then. All of a sudden, I saw that wine, and I had this overwhelming urge to drink. 27 years sober. And you can imagine what I'm thinking to myself, what the hell's going on, right? So closed the cabinet. I went upstairs and I went to bed. Could not sleep. Was up almost all night long. Toss and turn. I finally hung onto the mattress. The urge to drink was so strong. I'm holding onto the mattress to keep from going down there. And I'm thinking stuff like, well, you know, shouldn't this AA, you know, kick in? Or what's going on? Why am I, you know? So I thought, well, what I need to do. I got up the next morning and it wouldn't go away. I was still thinking about that wine and I was still obsessing. And I thought, well, I need to get to a meeting. So I went to a meeting that day. And I shared about it. I told them, and I didn't want to, that I had been thinking about drinking, and I got great feedback. And I went home, and I kept obsessing about that drink. It was unbelievably powerful. It was incredibly powerful. And I just thought, Jesus, what do I need to do? Oh, I'll call my sponsor. So I called my sponsor. I laid it out to him, and he said, don't drink and go to meetings. What? You know, he's full of wisdom, that guy. And so I'd run it by my sponsor. So now it's the third day, and I'm still obsessing. And I'm still trying to think about how to get this drinking out of my head. And finally the thought occurs to me, maybe you ought to pray. Okay, I'll try that. I'm desperate. So I prayed, and it was lifted. It was absolutely lifted, the urge. But I wasn't ready to accept what had just happened. And I said to God as sincerely as I could, God, please tell me what I'm supposed to learn from this. 27 years sober and want to drink like I've got 2 days, you know. And you know what the message came back was? It's still just one day at a time. No matter how much time you have, you got to get up. You got to pray. You got to work the steps. You got to go to meetings. You got to call your sponsor. It doesn't matter. You don't get a free pass because you got time. This is a disease that still lives in me, and so I still have to treat it on a daily basis. And I'm grateful for that. I just got back from a cruise. One of the artists I work with gifted my family, another little miracle, gifted my family with a cruise for a week. And all these musicians are playing. It was so much fun. And were the AA meetings good? Hell yeah, there was like 40 bands on there. So we had a great time. It was just beautiful. But, you know, it is just one day at a time. And if I can get through today, then I got tomorrow. That's the blessing, you know. The potential to do and be whatever I want to be. The freedom, happiness, joyous, happy, joyous, and free. That's the promise AA gives me if I'm willing to do those three things. Number one, put down the drink and don't ever pick up the first one. Number two, become teachable. I had to let so many people in so many rooms, so many sponsors, so many treatment people, I had to let them teach me how to live because my way wasn't working. And the third thing is be willing to change. And for me, change is a blessing today. Because I don't like what I was. I like what I am, and I want more. Like a good alcoholic or addict, I want more of this. And the only way I know to get it is to keep coming back. And I hope you heard something that will help. If you don't, just know I love you in spite of your damn selves, all right? Thank you.
Yeah, that was powerful.
I appreciate it.
I was having a conversation with a young man at Talbot, and he asked me, he said, you know, you've had time in this program. Could you sponsor me? And I said, well, unfortunately, I'm not a counselor here. I'm a patient with you right now, but I got a really good guy you need to meet. I met him up at 8111 on a Sunday evening and I introduced him to Jeff because I knew he'd be there, and I knew he'd do it if I asked him. You really do work the program you talk about.
While others live in high, a big piece of the pie.
just talk to myself, hide it from everyone else, save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it away. All I had me love, kept it on a shelf. He showed me how to love the world. Feel I could do it myself. Time.